I'm Bob Boylan with All Songs Considered. One of the most surprising records of this year is by the 1975. My preconceptions about their pop-leaning music and how I categorize them in my brain turned out to be so wrong. Their current album is called I Like It When You Sleep, For You Are So Beautiful, Yet So Unaware of It. And it's filled with influences from ambient music, R&B, electronica, and the 80s. I wanted to talk to Matty Healy about his influences. He's someone who I'd met back a few years ago when he performed a fascinating solo Tiny Desk concert. So, on this edition of All Songs Considered, Matty Healy plays DJ. His parents are both British actors, and we start by talking about the music they played around the house and in the car. And just a footnote here, we also talk about musician Leon Russell, and this conversation happened just a few days before Leon Russell died.
The first song I learned to play properly would have been House the Rising Sun by The Animals. But my dad's from the northeast, from Newcastle, so that was part of that whole thing. White is Shade of Pale, one of the first songs I learned. But my dad was very soul, so it was Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, all that kind of thing.
Are your parents boomers?
Yeah.
Just classic rock?
Well, I don't know. My mum is very kind of into like disco and Donna Summer and that kind of thing. She was very all that kind of late 70s kind of sound. My dad has always been the kind of the same that I have. It's always been about conviction. And I think that he found that in black music a lot more, you know, like soul and blues and stuff like that. He would always be about like, listen to this voice. I remember like whether it be, you know, Percy Sledge, you know, When a Man Loves a Woman, or the conviction in Otis Redding. I remember my dad being like, you know, getting excited about that, and me thinking, all right,
let's play an Otis song. What do you want to hear?
Let's do Hard to Handle.
Great.
Baby, here I am, I'm a man on the scene. I can give you what you want, but you got to go home with me. I forgot some good old loving, and I got some in store. When I get through throwing it on you, you got to come back for more. Boys and things will come by the dozen, but that ain't nothing but drugstore loving. Pretty little thing, let me light your count, cause mama, I'm sure hard to handle now. Yes, I am.
Yes, I am.
Oh, yes, I am.
So, I always loved the fascination that, like, for me growing up, it was my love for British music. Absolutely.
Okay.
And then for so many of the Brits, their love was always for American music. It's not that I didn't like Otis,
no.
Right? But there is that attraction. It's almost, I describe it almost as exotic music,
well, that's,
right?
It's the whole thing. Grass is always greener, right? I tell you what's a good example for that of my generation. It's something like Kings of Leon.
Okay.
I remember, and I know this sounds very off topic, but when Kings of Leon, I remember seeing them at Brixton Academy on like their second album, and they said, "It's so good to be home." And this is in London. And it made me kind of research the way that I'd realized that America didn't take to Kings of Leon in the way that the UK did, because you've got country music.
Yeah.
Country music is enormous over here. You know, Garth Brooks is the biggest selling artist of all time. So when we got the Kings of Leon, they were like these kind of indie cowboys. Whereas in America, they were kind of too close to cowboys for anybody to really care. So yeah, there is always that, there's a desirability for stuff that's just, you know, Otis Redding, you know, doesn't come from Birmingham. And you can hear that, you know, and, you know, the Stones don't come from Alabama, or, you know, the
right.
Who, you know, you can.
Though they wouldn't mind.
Yeah, exactly. They wouldn't have minded. That was probably a bad example. But, you know, or whether it be anything that's particularly anglified, you know, it's always going to appeal.
But authenticity maybe is what your dad was pointing out when he said, listen to this.
Yeah. Right? That's why I picked up on soul music so much. Because, yeah, for him, I think as being an actor as well, conviction and believability, believing in something, it was kind of paramount for him. Yeah, whether it be, you know, Roberta Flack or any of the Donny Hathaway. I mean, Donny Hathaway is the ultimate one for me, because there's the romance of the, you know, the mental illness, and there's so much of that kind of. He seemed to be exercising. It would seem a real catharsis for him singing. And when you listen to that, it can be really, obviously, really powerful.
We can play Donny if you want. It wasn't on your list, but do you want to?
I mean, we have to if we've spoken about it. Let's do A Song for You.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
I've been so many places in my life and time. I've sung a lot of songs. I've made some bad rhymes. I've acted out my life in stages with 10,000 people watching. But we're alone now, and I'm singing this song to you. I know your image of me is what I hope to be. I treated you unkindly, but darling, can't you see? There's no one more important to me. We're alone now, and I'm singing this song to you.
You taught it's another world, then.
Indeed. Leon Russell did a lovely version of that song, too.
That's the original that he wrote. Not my favorite. It's funny when you go back and you see that covers, when you find a cover that's kind of, I don't know, to be honest, better than the original. Songs that sometimes you give to other people and it's almost like that it was kind of designed for them. Do you know what I mean? That song in particular, a song for you, after you tour for years. I've been on tour for like 4 or 5 years, kind of on and off pretty much, and the lyrics in that song really resonate, because, you know.
Which part?
Well, you've got, I've acted out my life on stages with 10,000 people watching, and now we're alone and I'm singing a song for you. Oh. I would never do that because I'm English and we'd be kind of cringeworthy. But yeah, so it's a powerful song.
How about if I play something of yours? A theremin like sound that's going on there?
It's as close as we could get to a theremin without actually figuring out how to use one. it was just
is
really,
like a pitch follower?
It
or
was,
something?
Yeah. I don't know. You'd have to ask George exactly what it was. George is my right hand man, or he would call me his right hand man, the drummer and the producer of the band. So we write everything together. That, I can't tell you. For me, I think it was called that one.
Is that how songs come together? Yeah, just work and work off each other.
Yeah,
and
definitely. It's normally down to kind of both of our obsession with music, with other artists' music, and then kind of really in-depth, maybe over analytical conversations about one part of one song.
Because you're British.
Exactly. And then that'll turn into an obsession about one sound, which will then inspire it. You know, it's all accidents. It's like that brilliant Eno thing where he says, you know, inspiration doesn't come looking for you. It's not you can't just sit there and expect something to happen. It's like, you know, an hour and a half after playing with the same sound, when you move the module a tiny bit and then that's interesting. Oh, there you go. And then you go, you know, it doesn't come looking for you. So that's what we're quite thankful about the amount of time that we have on tour, because we kind of record every day.
So you're on the road and you're somehow finding time to record?
Well, you say somehow finding time. I mean, I'm doing this today.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're a very fortunate part in our career at the moment where we can kind of do stuff that we want to do. So it's not really like promo-y stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of the time, you know, if I get to the venue at 11 o'clock, I'm on stage at 7. That's just a lot of smoking and coffee, so I might as well be making another record.
So what do you carry with you?
The last two albums were pretty much made on laptops and then taken into studios and what you call, fluffed up, like made sound a bit better. Right. So all we need is a laptop and literally these Genelec monitors, we've got exactly the same as you've got in
here. They're beautiful.
Because it's the creative process and the recording process for us is one and the same. So we try not to let it get too sonic based. You know, we could sit there and try and mix a record, but that's not what we do. We just get loads of creative ideas down and then eventually address it and try and make something out of it.
That's good. I'm going to play something that when it came up randomly on a drive home, what I do oftentimes is, oh, this looks like an interesting record. I put a bunch of stuff in a playlist and I drive, and this song came on. I thought, I don't remember putting in anything like this. So, you know, I kind of remember the bands I put in my playlist.
Yeah.
Who is this?
It's me.
Let's play a little of this. This is,
I like it when you sleep, for you're so beautiful yet so unaware.
For those who don't know this piece of music, I'm just going to scoot down toward the end here because, like, random. But
there you go, there's the drop.
Did I just miss it?
No, that sounds good. See, it's very UK for me. When I listen to this, that's like the UK. That's how, what I hear.
When you say that, you're talking about walking down the streets and feeling the vibe of the city.
Yeah, and the kind of the influences there now. Like, I can be a lot more objective about this record. You know, I was kind of in it and now I'm out of it. And I can hear what I was listening to there, the garage music and the streets. And that sample is an old garage MC from London who died like 15 years ago that we used his voice on the record. And that's London for me, listening to that. I very rarely listen to the actual recordings, and playing them live is very different, so it's quite nice to actually sit there and have those feelings come to you.
Do you remember how this song, where you were when this song started to come together?
It's pretty much all George. Yeah. I think that we would, you know, me and George could never decide. One day we want to be in NXS, the next day we want to be in Boards of Canada, do you know what I mean? And each day we take that very, very seriously. So I think that This will have just been a conversation about, who can I hear in there? You know, John Hopkins, Sigur Rós, people like that. Just wanting to make something that was kind of representative of where we were, and God knows where we were. Oh, breaking my heart. You're breaking my
you
heart.
You want to be in this band too, don't you?
Oh, man, I want to be in every band.
Let's play a little of All My Friends. LCD Sound System. We may get hypnotized, and we may not come back.
I know.
Place to fade this out. This is incessant and wonderful.
It's just, it keeps going and keeps getting bigger and more beautiful. It's so funny. And so, you know, man, like that song, because that album will have come out when I was like 16, 15, yeah, something like that. And I remember hearing that song and thinking, okay, that's it. I'd found my song. I'd found my forever song. I'd found the song that I knew was going to inform every single song that I ever did. Because this song for me, like, you know, we could get into a musical conversation where I talk about the technicalities of why I love it, the fact that it's two notes, the fact that it's, you know, it resolves every couple of bars, but it always feels like a completely unresolved piece of music that's never going to end. It's like, you know, Sledgehammer by Peter Gabriel, it's got a fade out on it because you can't stop that beat going. And it's the same kind of thing with this. And this song, you know, it makes me think about life, it makes me think about death, it makes me think about friends past and present, and it's kind of everything to me. And I have rinsed this song in my career, technically, emotionally, like, it's kind of, and I'll say that with a complete, you know, like, with an unabashed freedom, because it was, I realized that I needed, if I wanted to do it, it needed to be as good as this. It needed to be funny, it needed to be self-aware, and it needed to be beautiful, and it needed to be, you know, it needed to be culturally aware, and it needed to mean something. But it also worked as a piece of pop music in the way that great pieces of pop music do.
Hang on, I just need more. James Murphy, have you met James Murphy?
I've never met James Murphy.
So what are you waiting for?
I know, I really want to meet him.
Hey, James?
Do you know James Murphy? Yeah, my tour manager knows James Murphy. I got a nod then. Exactly, we'll fix it up. But he seems like quite a, I don't know what I'd say. I met David Byrne once, and it was so anticlimactic. I completely messed it up. I just dropped my sweets and said, oh, sorry. And he walked off. Because I was like, his dressing room was next to ours, and I was doing that thing of, like, you know, hanging out by the door of the dressing room, which nobody does unless you're trying to, like, bump into someone. Totally uncasually trying to bump into David Byrne. So I don't know how I'd be if I met James Murphy. I'd want to eloquently tell him, you know, you informed my heart and I love you and the LCD is this, but I'd probably just mess it up.
Don't do that.
Don't do that. Yeah. Just leave it.
No, meet him, but go and just have a conversation, anything about him. And don't talk about him, and then it'll all happen.
Yeah, exactly. We'll try.
It's like this. It's like, I'm not asking you about 1975. Exactly. I'm asking you about James Murphy, and now I know a whole lot about you.
You're very, that's your way. Very good at your job. Yeah.
Now you have to figure out how to find out. So what do you want music to do?
It needs to change the world. It's different to what it was yesterday.
So for those who don't
know, today
is the day, morning we woke up to a new president-elect.
Yeah. And it's been, you know, we're talking about being English and stuff, being embarrassed, being slightly self-aware. I've not made a career out of that, but it's very much part of my identity. So to be quite forthright about certain things makes me quite self-conscious. politics is one of those things, because I feel like if I saw a young pop star, I'd be a bit like, what you know about in your white suit? You don't know anything. Do you know what I mean? But there's a part of me now that I feel like, I mean, what am I supposed to do? My band is now, you know, starting to become a very, very big band, a very important band to lots of young people who have just felt directly, you know, really disenfranchised by this situation. And we're talking about the Trump presidency. And if you look at, you know, the 18 to 25s that voted, we've got an entirely blue America. And the fact of the matter is that, so my responsibility was always artistic and it was kind of to myself. But now I know that my next record is going to come out within the Trump presidency, let's hope the only and the 4 years of it, but that's gonna happen. I think that now we have a generation that are far more engaged, and what has happened is that we've got, the internet has exposed how different people are, so there's been a hardening of positions on both the right and the left. You know, people have gotten more left and more right. I think there's more of an expectancy for art to be more actively challenging what we see every day. What will be interesting for me is to see how I incorporate that into the way that the 1975 works, because the 1975 is kind of like my diary. The way that I become endearing or people get to know me is through kind of it's quite clever. Do you know what I mean? I'm either really, really frank, or it's kind of conversational. It's not, when it gets political, it's still all about me. So I don't know how I'd make a kind of a record with a punk lyrical ethos.
And how do you, and does that punk ethos change people or just unite people? You're going to talk to your audience. Is your audience very much similar to how you feel, and do they need to be convinced, or do they just need a pivot?
Oh, yeah.
Or something to...
Totally, yeah. They just need something to cling on to. I mean, I'm not, you know, we talk about all of those things that young people are very interested in now, you know, kind of like social responsibility, equality, sexuality, all those kind of things, you know. They're all in there within the music already. So the people that we've, the kids that we've drawn in are very, very multicultural, and they find a real security in the way that the 1975 kind of stands for that kind of thing. So we very much stand against any kind of, you know, the promotion of any kind of inequality. So it's, we are preaching to the choir to a certain extent, but if we were to go on stage and, you know, start saying what was wrong with everything, but all we need to do is remind people that we are kind of united, you know, and it is
right. Or are they united to within the system? In other words, it's one thing to like all identify in a certain way and to be in favor of a certain thing, but if you don't do that within the, let's say, the voting system, as simple as something like that, the participatory part of the system, then what good does it do? You wind up with something that you don't believe in.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, China just said, this is what happens when you let people have a democracy. Do you know what I mean? I think that I don't know. It's because it all gets a bit idealistic, doesn't it? And it all gets a bit unrealistic.
Well, it gets preachy too.
Yeah, it gets a bit preachy, and that's another thing that we have a problem with.
And the other thing is, you talk about writing music, and I've never seen you write music, but it sounds like it just happens.
It just happens.
And then,
exactly.
You really need to listen to this Roger Waters interview we did, because there's so much in this is a mirror of that, which is that we talked to him about, he doesn't know ahead of time what he's going to write about. John Prine, who he brings up, who he loves, didn't choose to write a song about old people. It just was a part of the way he lived, and it just poured out of him.
Exactly.
And so I guess making a song that has such a definitive purpose is so hard.
Exactly. And you know, being creative in that way with an agenda, like the way I assume people find me endearing is because of how the for example, like the fragility that I lay out, or the kind of like I'm quite self-lacerating, like that's the way that I endear people, by kind of revealing parts of myself that aren't that good, but with a certain amount of distaste, so people are like, oh, I quite like that guy. Do you know what I mean? And it's very difficult to do that kind of thing with a direct agenda. We've got songs like Loving Someone, for example, which is very much, it's this kind of free form, just talking about the lack of empathy, the kind of global lack of empathy, really, for the want of a better description. But I suppose that's as kind of political as we get, But all I was really doing was talking about what I see and what I see the conversations are amongst our fans.
If people haven't heard it, play a little.
Instead of showing the kids that they matter, who are they gonna batter next? Just keep hold of their necks and keep selling them sex. It's better if we keep them perplexed, it's better if we make them want the opposite sex. And disenfranchised drunk criminal minds in a car park beside where your nan resides. Are not slow, they've just never been shown that you should be.
In that Roger Waters interview, I was telling you, I was maybe we'll hear. He played. We talked about, can songs make a difference? Can you know? For some, it was the wall, right? For the Pink Floyd record, of the course. Wall. For others, for him, one song he picked was "A Change Is Gonna Come" from Sam Cooke, a song that just was a uniting point, a place to gather, a song to gather around. For you, have you had that in your life? Have you needed that in your life?
But that's the thing. We spoke about the kind of need for that kind of thing. When it comes to, it's specifically politically motivated music, I never really had a need for that. Being from a kind of comfortable, white, middle-class upbringing, music for me was a very, very artistic pursuit, and I'd say a musical pursuit in the way that melody and structure and the mathematics of what made up the form is what excited me. And as I got older, I was like, wow, this is the most powerful cultural tool imaginable. Then obviously, you know, I listened to
hip hop,
The Clash and Bad Brains, and you know,
or these days hip hop.
Yeah, or these days hip hop. Do you know what I mean? Like the kind of the only truly subversive music that we have left. It's really, really interesting, yeah, where it comes from and what I picked up on. And I think that I'm fortunate with is that I grew up, it's not the other way round for me. And I think that's good because a lot of people get really, really involved in music because of the cultural element of it.
Right.
Or they get involved because, you know, maybe the first musical thing that they've loved, like let's say it's like The Clash or Bad Brains or something, and it sets them on a journey and then they may become kind of culturally influential artists, but it's still, for me, it's the artists that are truly, truly musical and do that as well. But I mean, again, I say that, and it's Sonic Youth are one of my favorite bands of all time, and that's a difficult listen at the best of times. Do you know what I mean? So, but music, I mean, I think music can change the world. Like, there's cultural ideas that are kind of set in stone through music, right? It's an incredibly powerful tool, and something that it's going to get really interesting now. It's going to get very active, the kind of the political side to music. Do you know what I mean? Because it's not been...
Well, for some in this country, the music that has come out of hip-hop has been central because they're living it every day.
Exactly.
If you're living in a different life that it's not a part of.
Exactly. Well, I mean, you look at what's really interesting as well, it seems like trap music, like what was called trap music, this kind of real weird breed of kind of lavish hip-hop sensibilities of, you know, the whatever you may call it, the rims and the things that people talk about, all the commodities of being a big superstar, but also with this really DIY punk rock ethos of making records in, you know, abandoned houses in Atlanta, do you know what I mean? But that's now become pop music in America, like Fetty Wap. They were like, oh yeah, that's great, I'll have that immediately, do you know what I mean? Because it sounds good. But that's what we're talking about, belief, isn't it? Because now, it's that whole thing of like the rise of like the hipster and all of that kind of thing, or the way that we identify with that kind of thing. It's like there's this desire for authenticity now. There always has been, but now there's this real, real desire for authenticity. And I think as soon as a glimpse of that is seen, it's immediately jumped upon and exposed. And that's kind of what happened to that kind of...
And exploited?
Kind of commercially exploited. I mean, you look at all of like every... Look at a Pret A Manger now, and it's got a tungsten light bulb in it, and it's a bare brick wall. Do you know what I mean? Like the commercial side of things jumps onto things so quickly. And it's also because what I find interesting now is cool. That's what really interests me, because being cool is just referencing things, right? It's just... And it was harder to be cool 20 years ago because you had to have seen that movie or been at that show or done this kind of thing. And now, because we all have a computer in our pockets and most of the time in our hands, we have the ability to reference it a million miles an hour. So our generation's first thought when we see something that we perceive as cool is to be suspicious of it and think, I'm not sure, you know? And everybody's got everybody else's number. That's what I find at the moment, which is interesting within music. That was just a digression.
I like the digression. I'm going to think about it. I'm going to play one more song.
I tell you what, then.
Yeah.
Let's play Michael Jackson.
Okay.
Because if we're talking about... The playlist that I picked was kind of like stuff that has informed me as like a musician.
Yeah.
And the end of this record is probably the most important moment of music to me ever because of the fragility
real emotion
in it. Yeah, because he cries, basically. And... putting aside the fact that when I was a child, Michael Jackson for me was this kind of this pantheon of everything, the only person higher than you know, people. So I grew up being obsessed with Michael Jackson. I saw him live when I was 7 years old, all these kind of obsessions. She's Out of My Life always stuck with me. It's a song by Tom Barler, is that right, Tom?
Yeah, H-L-E-R.
Yeah, Tom Barler. Beautiful love song. It's just a great love song, but Michael Jackson, for me, is the most concise, well-delivered, packaged artist entity of all time. Everything that you got from Michael Jackson when I was a kid was like pre-packaged and sold an idea that he wanted you to have. So it was so clean cut and brilliant, and everything was amazingly produced. Obviously the video, you know, I don't need to talk about the consistency of Michael Jackson, but the end of She's Out of My Life, he messes it up.
Not just once,
like a couple of times. Like, he really can't do it. And I know that there's this famous argument of him going, oh no, I don't want to use it, and Quincy Jones saying, we have to use it because this is going to be that moment. Now, when I was a kid, I didn't intellectualize it. I just thought, I felt something. I went, ooh, when I heard it. And now as a grown up, I've realized that that moment of fragility within a whole world of stylized, you know, like my band, basically, all these stylized things, all of these aesthetic arms, all of these kind of things, but it's nothing without the kind of the truth or the fragility at the center of it. And I think I learned the majority of that from that moment in this song.
Be well. Thanks for doing
thanks
this.
So much, Bob. Yeah, lovely to see you, man.
Yeah, good to see you too. Matty Healy of the 1975, their 2016 release is called I Like It When You Sleep, For You Are So Beautiful, Yet So Unaware of It. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
She's out of my life. She's out of my life. And I don't know whether to laugh or cry. I don't know whether to live or die, and it cuts like a knife. She's out of my life. It's out of my hands. It's out of my hands. 2 years she was here, and I took her for granted. I was so cavalier. Now the way that it stands, she's out of my hands. So I've learned that love's not possession, and I've learned that love won't wait. Now I've learned that love needs expression, but I learned too late, and she's out of my life. She's out of my life. Damn indecision and cursed pride. I kept my love for her locked